This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Cedarside.com, your all-natural, organic solution to pest control problems, protecting people, pets, and premises. Cedarside.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to tackle a very, very important aspect of health that we sometimes give short shrift to. It's sleep and the health ramifications of sleep and the prevalence of sleep problems that undermine Americans' health. We're going to talk to an expert. He's Dr. Robert S. Rosenberg. He's author of Sleep Soundly Every Night. Feel fantastic every day. And he's got a great website at, answersforsleep.com. Okay. www.answersforsleep.com. He has over 20 years of experience in the field of sleep medicine. He's board certified in sleep medicine, which is a subspecialty within pulmonary medicine. And of course, he's previously studied internal medicine. He's medical director of the Sleep Disorders Center of Prescott Valley, Arizona. And he has authored a book, Sleep Soundly Every Night. His advice has appeared in many magazines, Women's Health, Women's World, Parenting, Ladies Home Journal, Prevention, etc. And he frequently appears on TV and radio, lectures throughout the country to both the public and health professionals. So he's eminently qualified to answer all our questions about sleep. So are you ready to go, Dr. Rosenberg?
I am ready.
Okay, good. So first of all, why don't we talk a little bit about the prevalence of sleep disorders? Is this a ubiquitous problem in America?
7 to 80 million people, the National Sleep Foundation estimates, have one or another type of sleep disorder.
Okay. And does the culture sort of militate towards sleep disorders? Because I think I've looked at research that shows that the amount of sleep that we allocate or time that we allocate for sleep has been dramatically curtailed since, say, the year 1900, perhaps coinciding with the development of the incandescent light bulb, that terrible invention introduced by Thomas Edison in the latter part of the 1800s.
And even worse is the CFU and the LEDs, which give off more blue light and are making sleep more difficult. But yeah, most of the studies show even if you go from 1960, the average sleep time was between 8 and 9 hours, and we're now down to about 30% of people are sleeping less than 6 hours, which is consistent, unfortunately, with high incidence of obesity, increasing heart attack, increasing diabetes, and in part we believe it's due to the lack of sleep. So in terms of our environment, very much so, the lack of sleep is related to the infusion of electronics, burning the candle at both ends, computers in the bedroom, television in the bedroom, etc. And then the other major sleep disorder, insomnia being number one, but number two is sleep apnea, which 18 million Americans suffer from, is probably very much related to our eating habits, our fast food. We're having an epidemic of obesity, and with obesity comes a marked increase in the incidence of sleep apnea.
Right. Well, you know, it's paradoxical that sleeping more can help you lose or maintain weight. I mean, you think of sleep as it's a passive state, and you figure if you're running around doing stuff, you're going to burn off calories. Right. If you're just lying there asleep, you know, that's not going to burn off many calories. So how do you explain that, what seems like a contradiction?
It's a hormonal change. A couple of things go on. When we get lack of sleep, or when we don't sleep enough, we get an elevation of or changes in two hormones that very much affect the appetite. One hormone is called ghrelin, which is secreted by the stomach, and in people who sleep less than 6 hours a night, they secrete increasing amounts, and it's an appetite-stimulating hormone. Mm-hmm. And then we don't secrete enough leptin, which is a appetite-suppressing hormone. So when you try to figure out, well, why would people are more active, et cetera, why would they be gaining weight? It's because the lack of sleep results in hormonal dysregulation of these two hormones, which very much are probably responsible for the increased obesity as a result of lack of sleep. And in some studies, diabetes may be related in some ways to these hormones as well.
Does insulin fit into the picture in some way?
Yeah, very much so. Lack of sleep results in insulin resistance, as does sleep apnea. Both have been shown. The incidence of diabetes is increased. So lack of sleep does result in insulin resistance, probably because when we don't get enough sleep, we increase our body's inflammation. Believe it or not, lack of sleep results in inflammation. We release a number of chemicals called cytokines that it would normally would not be released in increasing amounts if we slept 7 to 8 hours. And these cytokines, these inflammatory mediators, tend to inhibit insulin's ability to get into the cell. And as a result, we begin to see elevated fasting blood sugars. And now the American Diabetes Association has a campaign to get people with prediabetes and diabetes to understand the relationship between their sleep duration and the diseases, and to try to get at least 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night.
And of course, this is a vicious cycle because, you know, the less you sleep, the fatter you may become, and then you become more at risk for sleep apnea because of overweight, and then
an increase in insulin resistance due to the very much obesity itself that causes insulin resistance.
Right. So it seems like a very, very prevalent type of problem. What are the first signs that would help our listeners be alerted to the possibility of a sleep disorder?
Excessive fatigue or sleepiness during the day, waking up in the morning feeling as if your sleep is non-restorative, waking up in the morning with headaches is very common in sleep apnea because of low oxygen and elevated blood pressures during the night. Also, if you're someone who has high blood pressure and your doctor is having a hard time controlling it, requiring three or more drugs, which we define as resistant hypertension, there's a fairly good chance that you may have underlying sleep apnea. As a matter of fact, recent studies, 60 to 70% of people with resistant hypertension had sleep apnea.
Yeah, and I've seen that. It's very interesting because I've seen some patients where they seem to be doing everything right. In one case, a guy, you know, he was exercising, he was lean, he was on a good diet, but for some reason, I after many minutes questioning him, I turned to his wife who accompanied him, and I said, "Does he snore?" And she rolled her eyes and she said, "Oh my goodness, does he snore?" You know, it's
great question.
So ultimately,
that's what you want. So that would be another. In other words, habitual snoring. If your wife or husband says you snore every night, especially if it's gotten louder, that could be a sign that you have a sleep disorder.
But not always. Just snoring per se is not necessarily.
No, snoring per se is not necessarily, but snoring certainly is a warning sign of sleep apnea. And if you're a habitual snorer, actually in pediatrics, in children, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that you thoroughly evaluate children who snore habitually for sleep apnea.
What would be the signs in a kid? A kid might be cranky or have trouble learning or concentrating.
Hyperactive, difficulty concentrating, difficulty staying still in school. The children tend to be more hyperactive than sleepy. Moodiness, irritability, wetting the bed. Those would be symptoms that are highly suggestive of sleep apnea in a child. And if a child was a habitual snorer, you certainly would want to get him tested to see if he might have sleep apnea.
So one point I think to make is that the amount of time you log in bed does not necessarily equate to efficient sleep. So sleep efficiency is an issue, not just the amount of time that you're lying supine.
Correct. So sleep efficiency, we consider 85% after the age of 50 or so to be normal, and 90% in younger people. But that's what we look at, is your total sleep time versus your time in bed. And we'd like to see you sleeping at least 85% of the time that you're spending in bed. A lot of people, on the other hand, stay in bed for 8 hours and they're sleeping only 4 hours. They don't get out of bed. They stare at the wall. They look at the alarm clock. Some of them take out their laptop in the middle of the night and go on the computer and still don't get out of bed. And this only makes the problem worse. The brain begins to lose the ability to associate the bedroom with sleep as opposed to other activities, and that heightens the insomnia. So, and in sleep apnea patients, they may sleep 8 hours, but because their sleep is constantly being fragmented, when they stop breathing, they wake up, although not long enough to remember it. They may wake up 40, 50, 60 times an hour every minute in response to an apnea. Even though their sleeping duration is 8 hours, their sleep quality is so poor because of the fact it was fragmented that they feel as if they haven't slept at all.
You know, sometimes when we try to establish what's natural, like, for example, what's natural in the human diet, we go back to Paleolithic times or primitive tribes, and we see what they ate. They didn't eat refined foods. They didn't eat, certain cultivated grains, and so we can use that as a reference. When it comes to sleep, there actually are suggestions that people's sleep was different in the era before artificial lights, and right. that sleep may have been bifurcated, that actually people slept for a few hours, woke up, you know, did a few things, maybe sat by the campfire, told some stories, or maybe had sex or whatever, and then went back and slept a little longer. Is there any truth to, I mean, some people have that sleep pattern. Is that necessarily bad?
That's not bad. I mean, it bifurcated sleep. There are some studies on people who sleep that way, but there was a very good study done about 6 months to a year ago, where they took a group of people out into the woods. Basically, they went camping. No artificial light at all was allowed. No computers, nothing. And many of them were night owls. And by the end of the first week, it was a 2-week study. Most of the people were falling asleep about 8 o'clock at night, when the sun would be right down for a few hours, and they were waking up at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and they were averaging about 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night. And their circadian cycle, after 4 or 5 days of being outdoors and being away from artificial light and blue light, that was the cycle, and that was the way they were sleeping, and that was their normal sleep-wake schedule. And when you go back to studies in the 18th century, that's about the time people would go to bed. They would go to bed about 8 o'clock at night and wake up early in the morning, 4 or 5 in the morning, milking the cows or whatever. But they were able to get to bed at a much earlier time because sunlight was really the only source of light that could disturb sleep.
I think Ben Franklin said it right, early to bed, early to rise, and you know right. The rest.
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So, yeah. You know, clearly that's a pattern that the body, you know, wants to adapt to. And there's
right.
so many
and
ways that we disrupt that.
Yes, and we disrupt it really with televisions and with computers and taking the iPads and the cell phones into the bedroom. So many of my patients want to know why they can't fall asleep. And when we convince them to eliminate that within 90 minutes or so of bedtime, it's amazing how many of them no longer have a problem with falling asleep.
This is a process that's referred to sometimes as sleep hygiene.
Yes.
And, you know, it sounds like, you know, brushing your teeth, you know, hygiene, or using underarm deodorant, changing your underwear. But actually there's a hygiene, curious right. word, that applies to sleep. So, you know, you described some of the guidelines for hygienic or optimal sleep. What are some others?
Well, first of all, let's get rid of caffeine within 6 hours or so of bedtime. And as we get older, let's move that to an even earlier hour because we metabolize it more slowly. So that's the first thing. Number two, let's pick the alarm clock and put it where we can hear it but not look at it during the course of the night. Because if you do suffer from insomnia, then the alarm clock, looking at the alarm clock causes calculation right. and anxiety and therefore is counterproductive.
Or the entire night sounds like the opening segment for 60 Minutes, you know, tick, tick,
right.
tick, tick, tick.
So when we get the alarm clock and people stop looking at the alarm clock and there's, you know, they're calculating how many more hours will I have to sleep, I'm going to be miserable tomorrow. So we need to, we also need to get the blue lights out of the bedroom. That includes televisions, computers, and the new CFUs and LEDs are much worse than the incandescent light bulbs were. So that's another thing we want to get rid of in order to improve our sleep hygiene. We don't want to take our worries into bed. I describe in my book a technique called constructive worrying. 5 or 6 o'clock at night, write down your problems, write down your worries, and whatever you do, put them away in a drawer and don't take them into the bedroom. So those are and we want it dark and we want it quiet. We don't want a lot of noise, and try to get a little. To wind down before bed, at least a half an hour to an hour before bedtime. Don't be doing work-related things. Don't be reading books related to work. Try to get things quiet. And even a hot bath can help. About 1 hour before bed, hot baths promote a drop in body temperature. And the drop in body temperature is what signals the brain, basically, that it's time to go to sleep.
What about the familiar remedy, which is the nightcap? One of my patients described his method of getting to sleep, which is he took 3 or 4 tequila shots before bedtime. Good idea?
Bad idea. First of all, after a while, you become refractory to the alcohol. Now, the alcohol will help you fall asleep, but unfortunately, the more you do drink, the more likely it is to awaken you in the middle of the night as it leaves your body. You basically get a withdrawal and an activation of the sympathetic nervous system, and the body temperature begins to go up. And going up, body temperature going up in the middle of the night is a major cause of an inability to remain asleep. So, and many alcoholics begin, especially children, adolescents, and teens who can't sleep, begin becoming alcoholics because they started to drink in order to fall asleep.
Indeed. Yeah, that's a big problem.
Sometimes,
you know, kids get into the liquor cabinet, you know, in order to help themselves.
Right.
Wrong way to go, but seems to be.
And exercise. Try to exercise regularly, you know. We used to say exercise near bedtime was a bad thing, but a study came out a few months ago that showed even night people who exercise within an hour of bedtime tended to sleep better and longer and fell asleep earlier than people who didn't exercise at all.
Yeah, that's interesting. And different strokes for different folks, because for me, that wouldn't work. I'm an early morning person, but sometimes, you know, I come home late at night and I look through the windows of the YMCA that's next to my apartment building. I see the people on the ellipticals, you know, working out at 11:45. Yeah.
Some of them, that doesn't bother their inability to fall asleep.
Exactly. A real blackout condition in your bedroom seems to be important, because I've heard that even very minuscule amounts of light can abolish the melatonin production. Is there some truth to that?
Yeah, bright light, especially blue light. I mean, you know, minimal light, it probably is not a problem. We actually can measure it in lux, which are units of light, 10,000 lux being the sunlight, you know, and the average incandescent light bulb gives off 300 to 400 lux. But yes, light of any type can, especially if you're prone to have problems falling asleep, when it strikes the retina, it will very, very quickly depress the melatonin production that your brain in an area called the pineal gland begins to make in increasing amounts at about 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And so light is a major inhibitor of sleep.
Indeed. So how do you evaluate someone for a sleep problem? You know, certainly you question them, you take a history, but now there's this whole science of sleep studies. What does that entail?
Well, a sleep study is when someone first comes to see me, we obviously begin with a number of questionnaires even before they walk in the room. I've had them do a week's worth of sleep diaries, what we call sleep logs. That tells them what time they fell asleep, what time they woke up, whether they drank caffeine. It's a very thorough way of evaluating them. But if it turns out that a patient might have sleep apnea, or if a patient has abnormal behaviors during sleep, such as acting out dreams, there you need a sleep study in order to make that diagnosis. And so the sleep study, the polysomnogram we do in the laboratory, monitors your brain waves, monitors movement of air from your nose and mouth, monitors the movement of your chest and abdomen, monitors muscle movement, and monitors your oxygen level. And this is all simultaneously. I think we have a camera to observe any abnormal behaviors, or if you have to go to the bathroom. But we're watching this. My technicians are watching this, and it's all printed out digitally on the computer. And then I review it, and if you have sleep apnea or some abnormal behavior during sleep, or even a seizure during sleep. There are people who wake up during the night and don't realize they're having nocturnal seizures. So these are things we can pick up with a diagnostic sleep study. A lot of things don't require sleep studies. For instance, if you can't fall asleep, I'm not going to do a sleep study on you because you have an inability to fall asleep. On the other hand, if you come to me and tell me you've always had trouble remaining asleep, you've never had trouble falling asleep, that alone might prompt me to want to do a sleep study to see if possibly there's some physiological thing that's waking you up that you're not aware of that would only be picked up on a sleep test.
Well, you know, the sleep study has been criticized on the basis that it's kind of an unnatural setting. You know, you pack your pajamas and your toothbrush and you go to a laboratory, and it's an unnatural setting. It doesn't necessarily replicate the conditions of sleep at home. So there's a revolution in technology. You know, just like cardiologists can give folks Holter monitors or event monitors that they can take home, I understand that there's going to be a revolution in sleep monitoring. Of course, there's now the iWatch and various wearables that people will be able to use to monitor various aspects of sleep. You know, motion detectors, maybe even heart rate, breathing detectors. I don't know about oxygen detectors. That's a little more sophisticated. But where do you see this going? Do you think eventually maybe people won't have to check into the sleep lab?
Well, we do home sleep testing. I have a number of home sleep testing units. They're good in diagnosing sleep apnea. they're very limited in diagnosing any other sleep disorder. I mean, we don't have brain waves. We don't even know if you're asleep or not. We have to go by what you if you tell us you're asleep or not. So they are limited, and they're not really good to use in people who are complicated, who have heart disease or strokes. But for screening, if you have an obese male or female with a history of snoring and no other sleep disorder, there's no problem in using home sleep testing when you realize basically you're looking for one thing and one thing only with a home sleep test, and that is sleep apnea. Now, once we diagnose the sleep apnea with the home sleep testing, if it's positive, in many cases we need to bring you into the laboratory in order to put you on what's called a CPAP. So you might eventually end up in a laboratory, but on the other hand, if the home sleep test is negative, then the next time I see you, I'll tell you, you know what, there's no evidence of sleep disorder breathing. That's not a problem. So as far as the accelerometers, the actigraphs that tell you whether or not you're sleeping or not.
Right, that's going to be incorporated in the iWatch, soon to be released.
Yeah, the Fitbit has it. They're already out there. They're good in terms of estimating total sleep time. They usually, most studies show they overestimate sleep by about 30 to 45 minutes because they really can't tell if you're asleep when you're not moving. They just assume if you're not moving, you're asleep. Now, the ones you have to be careful about, and I've written in my book and also on Everyday Health, are the ones that are purporting to tell you based upon motion whether or not you're in REM sleep or slow wave sleep.
Yeah, right.
Those, in my estimation, are ridiculous. It's not possible.
Right. All right. This is a good inflection point for us to break because we split these podcasts into two parts. So let's stipulate this as part one. We invite our listeners to join us for part two, and there we're going to talk solutions. We're going to talk about ways of treating sleep apnea. We'll also talk about the upsides and downsides of available sleep meds, natural therapies for helping people sleep, and whatever else we need to cover with today's guest, Dr. Robert Rosenberg. He's Sleep Clinic Medical Director at the Sleep Disorder Center of Prescott Valley, Arizona, and he's the author of a great book, Sleep Soundly Every Night, Feel Fantastic Every Day. He's got a website, and that website, once again, is, let's see, we've got it here, it's answersforsleep.com. We invite you to check it out. When we return, more on the subject of sleep. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.